Hello and welcome to Ecosystemic Futures Podcast, presented by NASA Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project in collaboration with Shushumworks, a global firm helping organizations and nations navigate ecosystemic transformation. As our world is increasingly digital and interconnected, ecosystemic models are reshaping the way society, industry, economy, and policy are coming together and reframing how we build for resilient futures. So I'm Diane Finkhausen, CEO and founder of Shushumworks, and today I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Vikram Shyam, futurist for NASA's Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project. Vic, welcome.
Thanks, Diane. Hey, so I've been at NASA for about 15 years, and I'm, like Diane said, I'm a futurist for the CAS, or Convergent Aeronautics Solutions Project, and my background's in aerospace, biomimicry, and foresight.
Amazing. Thanks, Vic. And today, we're thrilled to be joined by Dr. David Bray, Distinguished Fellow at the nonpartisan Henry L. Stimson Center, a non-resident Distinguished Fellow with the Business Executives for National Security, and a CEO and Transformation Leader. Dr. Bray, welcome. Thank you for joining us. Maybe share a little bit about your background.
Sure. And again, thank you, Diane, and thank you, Vikram, for having me. I say the short version is I fell on my head at an early age and it made all the difference. The slightly longer version, I've just been fortunate throughout the last 30 years, starting in a very early age, to have the chance to work at the intersection of technologies that were really only exquisitely available to certain parts of what government could do in the past. It was actually involving technologies with the Ballistic Missile Defense Organization in the mid-90s. Fast forward to countering bioterrorism into the 2000s. Later went and got a PhD, and then raised my hand to go be on the ground in Afghanistan in 2009. Thinking about some challenging counterinsurgency and humanitarian missions there. Later had an opportunity to review all the R&D efforts of the intelligence community. As a good nonpartisan, you mentioned the nonpartisan Stimson Center, I am a good nonpartisan myself. There were six from each side of the aisle, so 12 commissioners total, including two from the Senate, two from the House. And we reviewed all the R&D efforts of the intelligence community, then parachuted into a role where there had been about nine CIOs acting and permanent at the FCC prior to my arrival. I was number 10. There had been 9 and 8 years and survived 4 years where he moved everything to the cloud and also improved how the FCC delivered things. This was back in the mid-2000s. Then worked with Vint Cerf with the People-Centered Internet Coalition for 3 years, trying to actually deal with the challenges of both countering disinformation, but also making the internet more inclusive of communities. And come 2000, got asked to do another commission, this time 8 and 8 on both sides of the aisle. Again, two senators and two representatives. It was the U.S. and our allies and our friends, everything from cybersecurity, trust in the digital economy, supply chains, the future of bio and biotech, and the commercialization of space. And in May of 2021, the report was hand-delivered both to the president and the Congress. And since then, in the last 3 years, about 50% of our recommendations have either been implemented or drafted into law and policy.
Amazing. Amazing. We're going to have a lot to talk about today and may need a little bit more time. But David, thank you for joining us today. And thank you for the amazing work that you've been leading. We've been fascinated about the intersection of society, industry, and policy and how that shows up in the economy as well. And very specifically, with the level of interconnectivity in we're seeing in society and industry today, that obviously has to inform also the way policy comes together or governance comes together more broadly. And so the work that you've been doing is well ahead of our thinking in this space. How does this interconnectivity need to inform policy? And it, really, the work that you've been doing in advanced tech and society and policy, what are some of the big changes, the seismic changes that you've seen beginning to shape that shift over the past couple of decades?
Sure. And I'll give a full disclosure that what the work you're doing with ecosystemic futures is near and dear to my own heart. When I went and did my PhD, it was actually on knowledge ecosystems, which was back in the mid-2000s. And if you remember, there was this field, there still is this field called knowledge management that thought that if you could manage knowledge, you'd have great outcomes. And my contribution to literature was to say, well, in order for knowledge to be useful, you need, in some respects, need to be able to see the future. And if you can see the future and predict which knowledge is useful to have to which person at which time, then you're kind of omniscient and you don't need to manage knowledge at all because you can already see the future. And so if we're not omniscient, which I don't think we are, it's more about trying to use ecosystemic approaches to increase the probability of goodness emerging in communities, be they communities within an organization, across an industry sector, across an entire nation, or globally. And why this matters now in our era is I would say there have been three seismic shifts over the last probably 5 decades. And I open with my opening saying, I feel like I've been very fortunate and honored to be where things that used to be only exquisitely available to some isolated pockets increasingly became available. And that includes, in some respects, national security and intelligence capabilities becoming widely available and accessible. And I often tell people the good news is we're democratizing tech and data. The challenging news is we're democratizing tech and data because tech itself, it's how you choose to use it to decide good or bad outcomes. And I think that's where ecosystemic lenses are important. You can think about what we're seeing right now in terms of there are possible bio risks in which if someone got their hold on reagents and a do-it-yourself kit, they could actually construct some things. Now, I like to remind people that in some respects, botulism toxin, that doesn't take a lot of sophistication to make. I mean, that can be naturally done. But it raises responses that cannot be linear in nature, that we need to, in some respects, need to almost think about how if you went back in time 100 years ago and you said there's these things called fires, they're dangerous because they destroy buildings, they ruin lives and livelihoods, they cause property damage, but there's actual solutions that could come forth in the private sector in the form of smoke detectors. And those smoke detectors can alert you. And that, as a result, can create this larger ecosystem of fire response, fire detection, early warning, and getting sort of left to boom. Well, we may need to do the same thing for bio, whether it's for natural pandemics or human-caused ones. And in fact, we have H5N1 right now, where it appears there is a gap in understanding the instrumentation of our own Midwestern states when it comes to zoonotic diseases. And if we had instrumented things better, we could actually respond better. And it can be privacy-preserving, could be consistent with the Constitution. But that's the first reason why I say is that the democratization of tech has means that people now can do things, and the solutions cannot be, we cannot just deal with them linearly. The two other things I'll say real quick and then turn back over to you is we also are now more connected now more than ever. 2013 was the year there were 7.1 billion people on the planet and there were 7.1 billion network devices. Fast forward a decade ahead now to 2024 going on 2025, there's about 8.1, 8.2 billion human beings and about 45 to 50 billion network devices. We are now the minority. 2013 was also the year there was more bot traffic on the internet than there was human traffic. And so as we look at that future, again, we are now connected as a planet. Dealing with things in terms of just geographical borders may not make sense. We've got to figure out ways of doing incentives. And I often tell people, you don't tell ants where to go. You put sugar in certain places, you put chemicals in other places, and they figure it out. That's the type of policy making we may need to do as well. And then finally, the last thing is, we may be realizing the limits of classical economics and that the Earth is finite. Yes, there is space, but space is very hard to get to. And even then, it's not going to solve everything. And so if we need to figure out how do we update maybe a empirical-based approach to policymaking, given a world that has finite resources that may not be described in current classical economics, because we'll really make progress on adapting to climate change and everything else that's happening, we can also link it to jobs and job creation.
So David, you mentioned a lot of interesting points. I want to go back to your fire detector analogy.
Sure.
So fire detectors are kind of, they're a nice analogy because everyone kind of accepts that here's this threat and here's the ways in which we need to detect it and then here's the way to signal it. And there's these codes, right? There's these fire alarm codes and life safety, national fire alarm signaling, all of this stuff. So who's creating that for, let's say you mentioned pandemics, whose responsibility is it? And how do we agree on it, given that the potential, I mean, it's not one fire, it's like a whole bunch of types of fire. It's almost like talking about fire in space versus fire on Earth versus different types of chemicals. Yeah.
So in a past life, when I did counter bioterrorism, I signed up in 2000 for a little known program. It was only 30 people. I was the person that knew computer science and biology, and we existed in case a bioterrorism event happened. And if you remember, in early 2001, the Agile Manifesto came out, which was about following iterative development as opposed to waterfall. And I was an early adopter of it. But I was being told by certain people, follow the 5-year enterprise architecture, follow the 3-year budgeting cycle. And I'm like, no, we don't have a deal with the terrorists not to strike until we have our IT systems online. Like, we have to be ready now. And I got the scars from that. But as it is, I was also scheduled weeks in advance to give a briefing to our intelligence community, to the public health community, as to what we would do if a Bayerzone event happened and what we would use in terms of technology. That briefing was scheduled for September 11th, 2001, 9 o'clock in the morning. 8:34, of course, the world changed. That briefing was postponed. Did not sleep for 3 weeks. Stood down from Heidelberg on October 1st. Ended up briefing the CIA on October 3rd. Only to have the first case of anthrax show up 24 hours later. So I actually have a letter that says, thank you for your very timely briefing. Jokingly, I'm like, I'm never going to brief you guys again because things seem to happen. But regardless, so you raise a good point, which is if we're going to wait till we have perfectly agreed standards, how do we get started? And I often tell people standards are like toothbrushes. Everybody says they want to use one. They just don't want to use anybody else's. And so I actually do work right now. I'm actually working with a group on AI and healthcare standards for data. And we can get a little bit later as to why that matters in the ecosystemic future. But I raise that because I think the first step is probably just agreeing that this is a problem space we need to define. And then you can actually start to say what are either things that are already de facto standards that we can bring in or things like that. But that also points to, even in a world in which increasingly capabilities are outside of government to do this, governments still have a role of convening the space. Because if you leave it to industry by itself, they will not come together. And we know that's true in the space sector. I mean, the world's work that you do in NASA, it's true in bio. I also think there's a whole lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt for whatever reason being shared out there. I personally get concerned when people say AI plus bio is going to be doom. I'm like, no, the way we used to catch bad actors was not to limit their knowledge. It was to actually detect, while still preserving privacy, pick up on signals and say, why are they buying all this? Or why are they doing all this? There's something odd here, and that's still going to exist. But I would say the way you get started with this in the bio space is you've got to get together enough people that say, look, we've got to have a standard ISO way to do this because there is either going to be H5N1 as an issue, another future pandemic. We just experienced one. And the good news is, real quick before I wrap up, in a past life, what we used to do in the 2000s was I just cared about rates and counts. So in some respects, I didn't need to have any other standards other than what's the normal pattern of activity. And if all of a sudden the rate goes up tenfold, that is a warning of something. And so you almost don't need to define the universe perfectly before you move forward.
Makes sense. And I guess to your point, so when you're talking about things like CRISPR or gene editing, it looks like the market's projected to grow by maybe like 30 times in the next 10 years, right?
Yes, right.
Given that just the number of variations, the number of things available is going to be vast. And you're talking about, I was going to ask you about AI plus bio. And
yes.
The reason is when you talk about democratization and you put things in the hands of people, one of them is like, what are the safeguards? You want safeguards, you transmit the information. And the big debate now is it better to protect the IP being generated around AI code that's, let's say, the government's working on? Or just be open, knowing that the openness is going to allow us, let's say that we have a better starting point. It's just going to give us more visibility and everyone else more visibility and the checks and balances. So it looks like you're standing on the side of the openness and transparency.
I think openness and transparency, recognizing there are certain things, like you wouldn't expect any military general to broadcast to the world, here's my battle plans beforehand. Or similarly, if law enforcement was investigating a crime, they need to be appropriately open to the courts to get a warrant and everything like that. But there is balance. And in fact, I would actually argue we may be in a world in the United States and other nations, we may be in a world in which we've removed the ability for elected officials and those that are politically appointed to do the appropriate act of compromising on issues. Because now everything is 24/7, everything is out there. And I would actually submit that, you know, what the founders intended with the United States and other nations too, not just ours, is that representative governments are give and take. You have to compromise and you have to be able to go to your constituents and say, look, here's what I got you, and not have your own party say, yeah, but you gave the following thing up as well. And that representative forms of government are best when nobody's perfectly happy. And so I am a big believer in sunshine and openness and transparency. I think that's necessary. But I also think, again, there's going to need to be appropriate level setting. And this is actually, in the field of AI, I would say it's going to come to a head much sooner before even AI and bio. The question is twofold. One, I would predict in the next 12 months, if not sooner, patients are going to show up with apps on their phone that will claim to be AI and insist that they want to turn on the microphone in their doctor's presence. that's going to open up a whole big, interesting set of questions in terms of, is that possible or not? Where's the data going? Does the doctor have to give consent or the clinician have to give consent? What if your insurance company wants to get access to that? There's going to be a whole lot of dimensions in that issue. But the even more basic issue that I've been working with a group called Health Level 7. They're a nonprofit 501c3 that oversees all the health records. Right now, none of the health companies in the AI space are thinking about how do you label if and when in your medical record a clinician, be it a physician, nurse practitioner, or whoever, types up some brief notes and they get expanded upon into an actual 2 to 3 page summary by a generative AI system. Because if that gets put in your medical record, and then later that same AI, that same algorithm reads it back in, there is a awfully named, but it is a real thing called AI self-cannibalization, where if the same AI algorithm reads in as an input data that it previously did as an output, it can actually go it off the rails. The model starts to get hyper-focused and goes off the rails and breaks. And again, no AI company is thinking about how do I record interoperability across AI systems, because they're assuming it's only going to be one AI system to rule them all, which, as we know, is not free market. But we need to actually be thinking about these issues. And this is why I think there's a need for policymakers to have this space to say, how does the interconnectedness of the planet combined with the increasing availability of tech and data mean that we need to do policy differently?
To double click and go back to, by the way, I love the analogy of standards and toothbrushes. I'm going to hang on to that one for sure. But I think the evolving space economy, right? Speaking of policy and space, the evolving space economy is just a fascinating study.
Yes.
Right. Of really all the macro factors that we wrestle with, right? The geopolitical landscape, the technological kind of advancement and innovation, adoption, regulation. But you mentioned standard setting and government's role, right? And I think it's interesting to see the space economy evolve with a really strong, the growth we're seeing in the industrial sector, the commercial sector, balanced by the investment and sponsorship that we're seeing from a lot of the global public agencies. How do we need to think about, in this increasingly interconnected landscape globally even, how do we need to think about standard setting so that the investment this is long cycle investment is spent wisely, and so that we get the greatest level of interoperability and kind of integrity across the many space systems that are going up.
Right. And you're absolutely right. I mean, space, there's a quiet revolution happening where I think prior to around 2012, and V, correct me, I think we were dealing with less than like 2,000 satellites in orbit. And now we've seen at least a fourfold increase. And current projections are by 2035, if not sooner, it could easily be another tenfold increase in terms of the number of satellites that are in orbit. And that's just because there are these mega constellations. At the same time, if you'd gone back in the past 3 to 4 years ago and asked people, where should you put investments in space? They would have said small sats are where it's at, that you can miniaturize things, miniaturize the sensors, launch them, everything like that. And now, because of the actions, particularly of one very well-known space company, but others too, and I recognize NASA has contributed a lot to that as well, now we are able to launch and reconstitute things with heavy lift capability, where if we had to rebuild the International Space Station, we could do so in two launches. And so in some respects, big is back again, or it's going to come back again. But it also raises questions about collision avoidance and what are the standards for that and what are the responsibilities. At the same time, remote sensing increasingly, I can remember probably about 8 years ago, our National Oceanographic Atmospheric Administration know that oversees the remote sensing limits and said 1 meter or higher was what a commercial company could collect. Now it's about 0.25 meters. But there are other countries outside the United States that are actually going for even lower resolutions or higher resolutions and lower numbers. And so at a certain point in time, it does raise questions for companies as well as individual people. When do you have the right to not be observed from space? I often tell my European counterparts, does GDPR apply from observations from space? And so I would say finding a forum in which Hill staffers as well as executive branch members can increasingly be exposed to this, because the people that are often making policies and laws, if they only get briefings from one or two companies, might get a very one-sided opinion. You need to understand the entire space. The other thing is, I think also crafting how do you get ahead of possible issues? Because I think it's only a matter of time before, just like when railroads came along and we had the expansion of the West and railroads that were built, then we started to have great train robberies. I hope it doesn't happen, but I think it's quite possible that in the next 5 to 8 years, we will have a great satellite robbery. Now, whether that's a physical capturing of the satellite and taking the hardware, or simply compromising it through electronic means, cybersecurity means, and taking it over. But as these things are going so fast, particularly in low Earth orbit, that if they were to collide in each other, they can make it so not only do we have a collision event, but we can make it so that large swaths of the Earth's space near Earth's orbit could not be used. So I think painting a picture that both says, here's what's going on, here's the art of the possibility, both the good, but also the bad, and then balances with, you don't need to be paralyzed. Here are some actionable steps you can do going forward now.
You brought up an interesting point, David, with the space side of it. And I'm wondering, so a lot of the operations going forward in space, they're probably going to have autonomy built in. So there's going to be AI built into it. You mentioned the great train robbery type stuff. So there's a potential for larger impacts for people on Earth as well, I guess, from these space launches. And who's working to coordinate all of this stuff? What are the big actors in this space? And how's the geopolitical landscape, I guess? I mentioned before, we were talking about one of the people we had on before was Orbit from DARPA, and they were talking about the lunar ecosystem, the economic ecosystem. And it seems like every country, every region has its own version of, here's what we're going to do with resources on the moon or in space. And at some point, it's going to come to a head. So how do we coordinate all of this? And then you have these rogue actors.
Yep. Well, that's why the Wild West sort of fits the analogy at the moment. I mean, in terms of my view, the default state of international relations, I hate to say it, is anarchy. It is only through, again, we put sugar in certain places, chemicals in other places, and other countries do too, and other non-state actors do too. And that's how we sort of make sense of the space. And so you're right. There is a race to the moon, and it does seem to be, if I could characterize appropriately, there's those on the side of the Artemis Accords, and then there's those that are not on the side of the Artemis Accords is probably the best way to put it. And it could very well be whomever is the next president for the next 4 years could have a case where there is a landing of humans on the moon from a country not associated with the Artemis Accords that will raise very real questions, which is, what is the future of moon as a shared resource for the entire planet? Or in fact, are we looking at where now it's actually going to start seeing bases set up that may have both a civilian and military purpose? And what does that mean? So in some respects, I hope whatever the outcome is, again, I'm a nonpartisan, I swore an oath to the Constitution, not a party, but a Constitution, but whomever is the next president, I hope they get a briefing within their first 120 days, if not sooner, saying this could very well happen on your watch. And that's why, at least if you're buying into the Artemis Accords, that we're in this together, as opposed to every nation for itself, there's going to need to both put the investment in the actual getting us there fast to sort of make sure we actually are planting a flag for all humanity. And at the same time, being aware that it is an issue in terms of what is the future of the moon and what does that mean for the world.
Do you have any suggestions on what's the role for, let's say, an organization like NASA, right? So within NASA, there's several projects and everyone's working on technologies. There's so much stuff coming about. Is there any kind of responsibility, like ethical responsibility, as we're developing technology going forward to build into our thinking that you recommend?
I mean, I think the future of NASA, given the expertise that you have and everything like that, is to be the convener. And the one that actually begins to arbitrate when people are saying, well, this is the best way to do automation in space. And somebody else says, no, this is the best way. And maybe the answer is they both can coexist, or maybe one is a good way. So I think there's a role of NASA as a convener. There is the role also of the arbiter, because I kind of feel like we're repeating the 1890s, where there's a whole lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt, and there's a lot of polarization and everything like that. And so if you can bring objective analyses, or as objective as possible analyses, and say, here's our best understanding, that is useful. And I think that could be immensely useful, not just to the Congress and the administration, but also to the world as a whole, as a public good. And then I think there's actually a third role too for NASA, which is involving the public. The last thing we want is a future of space where it's only given to a few very large companies. That is not the future we want. And so hosting challenges where you invite the public and you invite universities, you invite students, you invite small companies, small businesses and startups to contribute. I think that's an immense contribution as well. And that's in keeping with the value of the United States, that it really is we the people, not just a few people, but we the people together. And I also think it is the beginning to have the conversation about what will it mean when we start going outside our own geographical boundary into the moon and beyond. What does that mean for collective identities? Yes, we're going to probably still, at least in the short term, identify ourselves as being with the country called the United States. But is that part of a broader coalition that has a larger sets of values that values individual choice, individual freedoms, and the like? And again, recognizing that we've had these transformational moments before. I mean, nation states as a concept really are less than 500 years old. And so we may move from nation states to networked nation states or something like that. But having that space where it's not just a tech conversation, it's a community and a people-centered conversation as well.
Yeah, so I'm hearing a third layer to NASA's role. And this is very consistent with conversations that we've had as well. But as continued kind of researcher, but also now even more so the educator, right, is a part of this orchestration role, right? We have an opportunity to open up a vastly new space, pun intended, for humanity. And we have to think together very carefully about what that means for society, industry, policy. And this is maybe a good opportunity to circle back to your third seismic shift, Dr. Bray, about really, and I would agree with you that the fact that we may be reaching the point where we are maybe knocking on the door of the existing limits of classical economies. We've been really thinking through this notion of the ecosystem as the new economic engine, the new economic frame. But of course, that transcends in many cases the boundaries of individual firms. It has the potential for redefinition of, to your point, nation states, right? So what does the future look like in terms of economic frameworks from your perspective? You obviously given this a lot of thought.
Yes, it's interesting you said it. So in a past life, I actually worked very closely with a colleague at a place called the Science Technology Policy Institute. This was back in 2009, 2010. She actually later went on to NASA. You may have known her, Dr. Pavia Lal. I think she was at NASA. So we were colleagues. We worked together and we teed up an internal paper on what policymakers need to know about complex adaptive systems. So that was more than 50 years ago. But I think that also applies to economics. I would say practically, because we actually touched about this a little bit earlier when we were talking about bio and data. The first step is recognizing there may be concepts that we think are individual or we think are community when in fact they're both. And I think data is probably the first place to start. In fact, if I had a magic wand, I would go back and I would try to unlearn the lessons of the last decade, including that really awful metaphor that said data is the new oil. I'm like, no, oil, use it up, it's gone. Data, use it, it's still there. And in fact, the more you involve the people that are associated with the data, the stakeholders in the data, the better it gets. They refine it, and pick up errors, they improve it, and it actually has utility. And so instead of hoarding data and trying to hide it behind opaque walls, which seems to be the current flavor of AI at the moment for certain companies, we actually need to figure out how do you involve people in their data, particularly when it comes to bio data. Because your bio data is not just your data, it's your siblings, it's your parents, it's your future children's data. It could be, it's also data about the planet, and it's data about evolution. And so we need to rethink things we thought were simply individual concepts as being both individual and collective. And then similarly, things that we thought were collective, we still need to remind that there is value in having choice and autonomy, that the last thing we want is to take that away from people. And so in terms of economics, I think it really is striving to think about whether it's data. Another area is attention. I mean, attentions are finite. And I actually wrote a paper back in 2007 where I said, do we need to reconceptualize individual attention and being almost like a finite resource like the planet? And if we pollute it, then we're doing harm to the individual and societies. And maybe that's where we are now. And so I think it really is, how do we upgrade economics to include not just that individuals discern things are finite and they'll pay more for it or something like that, but to identify the joint almost duality of individual and collective nature of things that include the planet, And then also recognize that there's always going to be a finiteness to certain things, that we all can't live next to the coast. We all can't. And so there needs to be trade-offs, and there needs to be recognition of both the value of individual choice, but the community as well. And that may need to be emergent in the sense that it's not based on mathematics. In fact, what I would love to do is actually, again, if I could wave my magic wand, get the Santa Fe Institute for Complex Adaptive Systems, along with NASA and a few others, to say, shape something that's usable for policymakers. And I find that policymakers like things to be zero or one. They like them to be very clear cut. And so it's going to need to provide for policymakers something that is clear cut. But at the same time, we're asking return for policymakers the ability to always be learning. I say able, always be learning environments. Because as we know, the nature of ecosystemic things is it's not that it's a clear path from A leads to B leads to C leads to D. It's that you're always adapting as the environment itself changes.
So I really like this lens of, it's almost like new objective functions for the economic model, where you're saying, okay, now let's focus on attention. Let's focus on collective individual metrics. But it almost requires you to, there's someone that needs to orchestrate this and say, here's what the ecosystem looks like. Here are the subsystems, here are the stuff that's moving around.
Right.
And then it's like attention itself. How do you mention the zero or the one? You need to put some numbers or some way of quantifying or measuring it. How do we go about doing this? Is that the problem you see?
It's definitely, and I think it's beginning to come to a head. And maybe it's just, I hate to say it, I look at my career and what I've done over the last 30 years. I usually go to places that are on fire, not because I want to be where things are on fire, but that's because then there's a clear and present mandate to do things differently. And so I think if we're looking for thinking about new economic thinking, given an ecosystemic lens, we need to identify where are things urgent enough that we're not making headway. In one area, actually, I've been working, and I'm going to give a shout out to the individual. Her name is Sharon McPherson. She has been making very substantive headway getting people from both sides of the political aisle to actually talk about how one can do job creation while also tackling climate change at the same time. And that includes, for example, cattle ranchers in Texas or something like that. And it's interesting because I think you have to link those two together, that, again, the founders of the United States and also founders of other Western countries and free societies, they recognize that everyone's going to have self-interest, and they could be self-interest of their individual or their party or whatever. But if you can wed that with the good of the whole, then you'll get good outcomes. And I think what we're really trying to do here, if we're trying to rethink economics, is how do you wed enough self-interest, given that there are currently people that like the current economic system, or they like the current way of thinking, or that's just what they know as researchers. How do you incentivize them to create something new, given that, again, universities don't always reward, and the time horizon for tenure is hard. And so it may actually take, this actually may be one case where, whether it's philanthropic donors or a very concerted effort that says, the government says, look, we're not making headway. We spent decades trying to tackle this falling issue and we've not succeeded. We're going to have to put money here to actually solve, and we're going to divide things into three categories: things that are achievable in 2 years, things that are achievable in 5 years, and things that are 10 year off. And we're going to require an equal one third split, because I know, again, policymakers need to show results in 2 years or less. But if we only look at 2 years or less, we're going to miss the decade ahead changes that will also happen.
Do you agree, though, that we've gotten to the point, or we're getting to the point, we're approaching the point where advanced technologies make this kind of modeling and optimization more achievable, right? So modeling the utility values at the individual level, the firm level, the macro level, and then linking those to scenario horizons, scenarios within multiple horizons, we can actually begin to run those scenarios with greater fidelity, given the advanced technologies, right? We have better tools to be able to run those trade-offs and assessments.
Absolutely. And in fact, so he was one of the forefathers of AI, Herb Simon, who later won a Nobel Prize. One, his PhD, he did it actually studying government decision-making, I believe in New York State. I could be wrong, but it was government decision-making at the state level. And he realized that the trouble is, left to your own devices, you never really go beyond the bounded rationality. You're always sort of stuck in sort of not too far from the status quo. And so whether or not that motivated him to go later do AI or not, I'm unclear, but I share that because he wrote later what's called the science of the artificial. And he points out that we need to recognize, not only are we creating these machines, these artificial intelligence, but our whole orchestration of everything we do economically, everything we do in terms of society and civic and policy, that's all artificial too. I mean, we have chosen to create it, and we can choose to uncreate or change, create different things. And so you're absolutely right that now with both the democratization of Internet of Things, the democratization of data and computing, we now can actually run different models with a higher degree of fidelity. And that actually leads to an empirical, and again, economics was never empirical except for behavioral and experimental, which came later. We can actually have an empirical, what I would call science of systems, and actually be able to say, well, this is what influences community decisions around attention or health or money or whatever. And then it bubbles up to this community level, and then it bubbles up to this nation or regional level, and it bubbles up to this global level. And we can also begin to identify when literature is in conflict. In fact, I was just having a conversation with a different part of the government, U.S. government, I won't say which one, but there are cases where current advice in healthcare, there's actually two different conflicting recommendations for physicians. And so those same systems that can model the science of systems can also identify when the literature itself may have conflicts in terms of what to do for health or what to do for attention. And therefore, it can actually identify for policymakers and just practitioners in general where we actually need to actually have better research to tackle these issues together.
I'm wondering, though, I get the potential benefits of using AI modeling. People are not talking about quantum computing, for which I'm on the fence about. But yeah, but a lot of this is still, in my opinion, quite nascent, partly because we were discussing that earlier today about neuroscience, and we're still almost in the infancy of understanding how the brain works, and our AI algorithms, the hardware, it's still at a very crude level. It's like this neuronal type view of the brain, when our brains, the axons, the glial cells, all of these things are being used. And yeah, and so all the biases that are baked into our thinking are going into these AI models. And so when you're talking about these conflicting things, it still comes down to who's programming them, what rules are you putting in. It's going to vary by region, by country, by the demographics. So ultimately, some human is going to decide whether or not this thing makes sense or not. And then when you talk about the economic model, ultimately you have to experiment on it. So are there good prototypes? Are there like places where you can experiment without things blowing up?
Sure, I'll give two specifics. One is, when I did my postdoc, I worked, one of the two places I did was with Tom Malone, Professor Tom Malone at the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence. And I'm a big believer in what I would say is collective intelligence, humans and machines collectively behaving as if they were smarter, not just one or the other. And in fact, I would say that is representative societies. And while we were there, one of the things they pushed out was that was called the Climate Collaboratorium, which was trying to recognize there are different climate models out there, some that deal with the regional scale, some that deal with the global scale, but being able to actually have the ability to have interoperability across them and to trade out things and see how the model does differently. And so I would say that is a model for what we could do when it comes to understanding the body, understanding the brain. I would love to see NIH and maybe with NASA, let's begin to have different models of different parts of the human body and then bring them together, or different animals and different organizational systems and plant systems and things like that. And yes, again, standards are like toothbrushes, so we'd have to work on the interconnects, but that's doable. We'd be able to solve it. The other area where I would say, and this was something, again, when I was with the Science Technology Policy Institute about 15 years ago, I said, what if we actually got to a point where computing allowed us to run a million, if not a billion, models in parallel, each trying to predict the next day? And again, one, we have to make sure we do it in an environmentally friendly way. And two, it's going to miss things because it might be right up until Saturday, and then all of a sudden Saturday breaks and we realize there's these things called weekends. But you now see people like Carl Friston and others doing what's called active inference. And I think actually that's going to at least augment, if not replace, our current deep learning models. And that you think about what a kid does. A young three-year-old will drop something and they'll say, I saw it fell. They'll drop something else. Maybe it's a food. They'll drop it. They'll drop a plate. And they begin to conclude, if I let something go, it falls. Up until the time you give them a helium balloon and they let go of the helium balloon, and all of a sudden it goes up. They're like, there's an exception. Something has changed. And so I don't think you have to completely understand the human brain before you can begin to create interesting models. You don't have to completely understand all of the planet before you can create interesting models, as long as you're doing the scientific methods, it's looking for the exceptions. Because that's when new novel discovery happens, which is, I thought every time I dropped it, it fell, until I let go of the helium balloon and it did something different. And so that gets to be interesting. And so I think we can begin to use the machine models to point out the things we're missing versus the things that, and actually can identify gaps in the current. And I think it would also be a way to solve that. I feel like, and I realize academia is meaning and it means well, we've become so specialized that we're not looking across the interconnects. And so maybe in some respects, this whole approach will allow us to look across the interconnects of disciplines as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I think you just reminded me of a talk that we had with Colonel Jason Drew on basically the science of strategic play. And he was a big advocate of really constructing experiments to your point, to just really accelerate learning and experimentation through by trying to break those assumptions, to your point, and working at the intersection of traditional domains and kind of scientific practice can probably accelerate the discovery of those exceptions. And just real quick, I know we're running out of time. My goodness, Dr. Bray, you've given us a lot to think about here, but if we could maybe just go back for our listeners, go back to your three seismic shifts, if you can just recap those for our listeners, and then we'll hand it over to Vic. I'd love to have Vic your thoughts on some of the key takeaways that you have amassed during this conversation, and then we'll wrap it up from there.
Sure. So I'll do the why, what, and the how to wrap it up for folks. The three whys as to why we need to embrace ecosystemic future lenses for how we tackle the world is one, we have made available technologies that were only available to exquisite actors. The CIA and KGB 50 years ago are now available commercially. You can buy it through your smartphone and other means. The second is we are now connected more than ever, that there are now anywhere between 45 and 50 billion network devices to a world of 8.2 billion human beings. And finally, recognizing that we may be hitting the limits of what classical economics can do, given finite resources, be it finite attention, a finite planet, finite, just certain abilities to tackle things. Now, the what, I'll say real quick before we turn it over, is we've got to embrace new ways of informing policymakers, their staff, and things like that in a way that exposes them to multiple sides of the issue, that we cannot expect just one lens to solve everything. Two, we need to always be learning environments, EGLE, always be learning environments as a way to tackle this. And three, I think we were just talking about the need for curiosity, that we actually need to have strategic curiosity. And I realized that, especially for policymakers, curiosity is often seen as a risky thing. And so maybe it's going to need to be a place where you find either universities or nonprofits where it's okay to be curiosity that has a bipartisan oversight board. But if we don't embrace curiosity, we will fall increasingly behind. And the how? Well, hopefully this is the spark that lights the fire and we go from there. Thank you.
Thanks, Stu. Yeah, I guess, Diane, I'll try to summarize this a bit. At least for me, the big things here were maybe the role for NASA that David elucidated was one of them being convener, the arbitrator, and then an educator, which again connects to what you talked about, the curiosity and maybe this humility, trying to keep learning. But then also one thing I took away, you were talking about job creation and climate change and these like short-term horizons. It seems like with the speed at which technologies proliferating, being adopted even, that the time for each thing to get into application is so short now that I think it's almost the responsibility of everyone to think in those terms, like how can someone that's implementing this do this in a way that's not confusing, that's transparent, and that's trackable, traceable. And so I think everyone needs to think in these time horizons. And then the other thing I found interesting was the economic systems and the tech lens on it, these time horizons, I think would help with that, which is something I took away from this. If we build in that long-term thinking into our technology development, now we're giving the economists, we're giving the systems planners these metrics from the ground up to put into these models to get some results. So I like that. And then you mentioned the balance between transparency and limits in terms of AI. So those are my big takeaways from this. Diane?
Yeah, great points. And yeah, I share your, I guess, fascination with these new models, right? I just think that we are getting to the point where this level of interconnectedness and interdependency, right, and these general purpose technologies are really breaking the frame, so to speak, and introducing an opportunity and maybe a responsibility to rethink the economic models, right, and engines that we rely on to power our systems. I think We have an opportunity here to take a look at how we might be able to refactor some of the utility and the way we're configuring levers, economic levers, in order to drive more systemic gains and benefits, and start to harmonize the individual utility against the system utility. I think there's more to be unlocked there, and I'm excited that we have folks like you, Dr. Bray, and you, Vic, thinking about this. And then too, that really also introduces an opportunity for new roles for organizations like NASA and many others, right, in this new economic landscape. So again, thank you for a great discussion. We know it would be, and I think we'll probably drop some of those white papers and references into the show notes. There's some good stuff as well in there. So again, thank you, Dr. Bray. Vic, also thank you for joining and really investing in a great discussion here. Listeners, if you've enjoyed this conversation, we would welcome you to subscribe to the series and join us in Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcast feeds. And you can always find this on socialmarks.com. So thank you again. And please join us for the next session.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dean. Thank you, Beth.